Today is Thursday, May 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, British Prime Minister Theresa May went to Parliament on Wednesday in hopes of salvaging Brexit. Just how was her proposal received?
By trying to satisfy every side, it appears that she's satisfying none of the sides at all.
Also, European Union parliamentary elections are set to get underway on Thursday, and we take a look ahead, as well as we take a look at microbrewing a long, long time ago. These stories and more are ahead on today's International Edition. British Prime Minister Theresa May dug in Wednesday against a relentless push by rivals and former allies to remove her from office as her attempts to lead Britain out of the European Union appear to be headed for a dead end. May resisted calls to rip up her tattered Brexit blueprint and in her embattled premiership after her attempt at a compromise was rejected by both her own Conservative Party and opposition lawmakers. May had promised to give lawmakers a vote on holding a second referendum on whether or not Britain should exit the European Union, something commonly referred to as Brexit. And in addition, May offered up a deal on a temporary customs union for trade, which the Labour Party wants, but May's own Conservative Party opposes. To get a bigger picture for what is at stake, my colleague Mario Ritter Jr. spoke with VOA reporter Henry Ridgewell in London about Prime Minister May's latest proposal.
Well, Theresa May says that she has made significant changes to the withdrawal bill that she wants to bring before Parliament following talks with the opposition party, the Labour Party, here in Britain. The most significant of those, and the one that's getting the most headlines, being the possibility for MPs in Parliament to vote on having another referendum to put it to the people once more on whether they want to leave the EU on the terms that Theresa May has negotiated, or possibly not to leave at all, or possibly to leave with no deal whatsoever and just to crash out on October the 31st. So that is the biggest concession that she's given to those who are opposed to her deal. There are some other changes as well that she's offering, for example, more safeguards on workers' rights, on labour laws, which is something that the opposition party had demanded as well, more guarantees on environmental standards. So really meeting more of the European standards on these things than she had previously intended. So those are the main changes that she has put forward in this bill. But by trying to satisfy every side, it appears that she is satisfying none of the sides at all.
Will Conservatives support the idea of a second referendum?
There are very few who I think would support a second referendum. It depends on whether Theresa May and the ruling people in her party, the government whips as they are known, tell the MPs to vote for or against this this option of a second referendum. Last time this was suggested, it was clear that she would tell all her MPs to vote against it, and I think she would probably do the same thing again. I think a majority of Conservative MPs see it as their duty to follow through on the 2016 referendum because they were elected a year later in 2017 with that pledge in their manifesto. And most of those who have spoken about this new bill say to even the suggestion of another referendum would be dishonourable. It would be going back on that promise that was made in 2017 to follow through with Brexit.
What is May offering on the temporary customs union, which Labour seems to want, but which Conservatives oppose?
Yes, this is one of the major policy areas of difference between the two parties. The Conservatives, by and large, want to leave most of the legal structures of the European Union, such as the customs union and the single market, which they believe would give Britain maximum scope to negotiate new trade deals with countries outside the European Union, like the United States, who want Britain to leave the European Union rules behind and to negotiate new trading agreements on things like agricultural products, or it might be Australia or South Africa and so on. That's what the Conservative Party wants. The Labour Party, the opposition, say that it's more important to keep supply chains, for example, flowing freely, to protect jobs in Britain. And the fact that most of our trade is done with the European Union means we should still abide by customs union rules. So Theresa May had offered a temporary customs union on goods only, not services, up until the next general election, which is scheduled to be in 2022. The Labour Party said that that wasn't good enough. They wanted a deeper customs union and a permanent customs union written into law as part of this agreement. So that's another reason why the Labour Party say they can't support Theresa May's latest plan, and another reason why it looks set to fail. It's also worth mentioning, though, that it is quite likely or quite possible that the next general election will be much sooner than 2022. If the current government fails to get Brexit delivered, it could be that we could be going back to the polls very soon. It's looking very difficult for Theresa May at this point. She had said yesterday when she was preparing to present this bill to Parliament today that it was the last chance, that this was the last push, that she had compromised significantly after those failed talks with Labour. So it's very difficult to see Theresa May succeeding from here. The only caveat of this is that on Thursday this week and throughout the next few days, Europe, every European citizen goes to the polls to vote for their new MEPs in Brussels. And if both the main parties, the Conservatives and the Labour Party, do very badly, as is expected, that might spook enough of their MPs to think, OK, we've got to get Brexit done because this is really making the electorate angry, so we'd better vote for Theresa May's deal, get it over and done with, and then we can regroup afterwards. There aren't many signs of that happening yet, but we'll know for clear on Monday next week the results of those elections, and I think that will give us a better idea of the state of the two main parties here in Britain.
That was reporter Henry Ridgewell speaking with my colleague Mario Ritter Jr. And as Henry mentioned, citizens in the European Union head to the polls beginning Thursday to choose their next members of the European Parliament. Those elected will shape the course of the EU over the next 5 years. In one of the most hotly contested campaigns so far, migration and identity are playing a big role. For a preview of that vote, International Edition's Kim Lewis spoke with reporter Catherine Field.
The elections will be taking place over 4 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, in the 28 member states. Are for members of the European Parliament. Now, there's 751 members of the Parliament. They will serve a five-year term and they will take their seats on the 2nd of July. It's generally thought that this European Parliament over the past few decades has lacked teeth. It hasn't really been able to get in on some of the more important issues of the day, which tend to have been taken over by national governments. But pretty much since the migrant crisis in 2015, it has had much more of a focus on giving the European Parliament the tools to be able to deal with European-wide issues. So they are coming into a phase where they will be dealing with more of these Europe-wide issues, and it's not just migration, it's also going to be on matters such as the environment, climate change, and also security.
Who will actually be voting in these elections?
Depending on which country, whether it's people who are on the electoral roll, age 18, some countries have different rules, but generally anyone of the people on the electoral roll in these 28 countries will have the right to vote. Now, there comes then the next problem, which is, will they turn out to vote? And that's always, again, been the problem with the European parliamentary elections, that people feel, voters feel just a little bit divorced from it. They don't really have a day-to-day following of it. So they are concerned that turnout across the European Union 28-member bloc will be low. That means somewhere between 40-45% turnout.
And who is considered to be among the biggest winners and losers?
At the end of the day, the Parliament will probably end up looking pretty much as it does at the moment, which is the centre-right, centre-left and centrist parties will probably have around 430 seats, so that's more than the majority. The biggest winner, it really does depend. What everyone's looking at is how will the populist parties fare in these elections. These are the first European parliamentary elections since there has been this wave of populists and nationalists taking power in member states. So the big question will be, will these parties be able to scoop up the votes that they keep saying they will be able to? They will be the big winners if they push out the traditional parties in their home countries. And certainly all eyes will be on France, where President Emmanuel Macron's party is pretty much neck and neck with the far right, Marine Le Pen, her National Rally Party. How that works out will really be an indication of what this big country of France feels about the European Union. So have a look at that one, because that will really be a midterm verdict on President Macron, and it will give an indication as to really what this key member of the EU, what the electorate feels towards the European Union. Will it be pessimistic? Will it be an electorate that will go for these populists who are standing for power? Or at the end of the day, will they just do what the opinion pollsters are saying, is they might not really like the way the European Parliament is running the show, but they do have a positive feel for the European Union.
That was reporter Catherine Field speaking with International Edition's Kim Lewis. Here are other major stories from around the globe. As tensions with the U.S. mount, Iran's supreme leader has said the country's president and foreign minister did not act as he wished in implementing the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers. The United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly Wednesday to demand that Britain end its colonial administration of the Chagos Islands, which include the U.S. airbase on Diego Garcia, and return them to Mauritius within 6 months. Syrian opposition fighters said Wednesday they recaptured a village on the edge of their stronghold in northwestern Syria that had been seized 2 weeks earlier by government forces. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Have you ever wondered how much our home galaxy weighs? Well, according to recent measurements astronomers call the most accurate made so far, our Milky Way galaxy weighs about 1.5 trillion solar masses. That's the equivalent of 1.5 trillion suns. The astronomers gauged the mass of the Milky Way with the help of NASA's Hubble Space Telescope and the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite. Writing their findings in a study to be published by Astrophysical Journal, the astronomers remarked that of the galaxy's total mass, only a few percent comes from what they estimate to be its 200 billion stars and the 4 billion solar mass giant black hole at the center of the Milky Way. The study suggests most of the remaining mass can be attributed to the mysterious and invisible substance known as dark matter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. It was a very tense day in Washington Wednesday as President Donald Trump drew a line in the sand over the ongoing investigations into him by congressional Democrats, a rare bipartisan commitment between the White House and Congress to make a sweeping agreement on infrastructure has dramatically collapsed. According to those present, U.S. President Donald Trump refused to shake hands with lawmakers or sit for a scheduled Oval Office meeting with congressional Democrats Wednesday morning. A visibly angry Trump left 3 minutes later, heading into the Rose Garden to inform a hastily arranged news conference.
And I just saw that Nancy Pelosi, just before our meeting, made a statement that we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up. Well, it turns out I'm the most, and I think most of you would agree to this, I'm the most transparent president probably in the history of this country. We have given, on a witch hunt, on a hoax, the whole thing with Russia was a hoax as it relates to the Trump administration and myself. It was a total horrible thing that happened to our country.
However, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer took issue with the president's remarks that he was prepared to meet and discuss the topic at hand.
It's clear that this was not a spontaneous move on the president's part. It was planned. When we got in the room, the curtains were closed. the president, there was a place for him at the front so he could stand and attempt to tell us why he wouldn't do infrastructure. And of course, then he went to the Rose Garden with prepared signs that had been printed up long before our meeting.
Well, via Skype, VOA's Jim Bertel asked White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman what led to today's events.
Well, what led to it apparently was just prior to the meeting in the Oval Office, a statement that Nancy Pelosi had made accusing President Trump of a cover-up with all these investigations that Congress is trying to conduct.
What exactly did Mr. Trump say during his comments?
So in the Oval Office, the president berated House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for her comments earlier in the day, accusing him of a cover-up. He also asserted that he was the one who really wanted to do an infrastructure deal more than the Democratic leadership, but that under these circumstances, it couldn't be done. So get these phony investigations over with. That's what the president says he told the two Democrats who came over from Capitol Hill. Now, there was some more about this that was revealed by Schumer and Pelosi when they spoke on Capitol Hill shortly after the president's remarks in the Rose Garden. Chuck Schumer said to watch what happened in the White House would make you drop. And the Senate minority leader is saying that basically the president was looking for a pretext to blow up this meeting, and Schumer accusing the president of being forced to run away when he couldn't say how he would pay for an infrastructure bill. He just took a pass, said Nancy Pelosi, adding that she prays for the president and for the United States of America after this scene today.
Well, now it seems like the president has drawn a line in the sand. He's not going to work with the congressional Democrats as long as these investigations continue. So where do we go from here?
Well, I think we also need to keep in mind that prior to this meeting, the president had given indications that he wasn't really going to strike a deal on infrastructure. He had sent a letter to Pelosi and Schumer the previous evening saying that before we can talk about infrastructure, first we have to get this trade deal done, the USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. So where we go from here, I think at this point, the ball is in the court of Congress. They are the ones, especially the House Democrats who control that chamber of Congress, about whether they will go for some sort of impeachment inquiry, which I think many people on both sides of the aisle agree would really hold up passing any sort of substantive legislation until we have an election. And the president alluded to that, too, today. He also accused Democrats of holding a meeting right before Schumer and Pelosi came over to the White House to discuss what he called the I word. He said that several times in reference to impeachment.
Now, briefly explain to us why impeachment would be a risky strategy for the Democrats.
Yes, there are a number of Democrats, including at least until today or yesterday, Nancy Pelosi, who thought that this would just put the focus on impeachment and nothing else, and that this could be ammunition for the president in his reelection campaign and have him painted as a sympathetic figure and perhaps draw some people out to vote on Election Day in November of next year and vote for the president, who might have stayed at home or have been inclined to vote for somebody else.
And the Senate is still controlled by the Republicans, so even if the House impeaches him, how likely is he to be removed from office?
Well, it's not going to happen. And that's something that Nancy Pelosi has also said, even though we've had one Republican member of the House say that he thinks there should be an impeachment inquiry. And we have a number of Democrats saying that. Nancy Pelosi has said that doesn't amount to bipartisanship. There needs to be bipartisanship in the Senate, which is the body capable of removing the president. So, again, this could just be an exercise that the House would go through, much as happened to Bill Clinton, who was impeached by a Republican-controlled House and not removed by the Senate.
That was VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman via Skype speaking with VOA's Jim Bertel. Indonesia has introduced curbs on social media in a bid to prevent the spread of hoaxes, some calling for violent post-election attacks and quell 2 days of protests in the capital. Reuters' Francesca Linaw reports.
Joko Widodo's re-election as president has sparked chaos on the streets of Jakarta. Supporters of the opposition candidate Prabowo Subianto were met with tear gas on Wednesday. They threw fireworks and debris in return. The country had been awaiting official results since the April 17th election. But on results day, Subianto refused to concede defeat. He said he believes there had been widespread cheating in the polls and was making legal efforts to, quote, defend the mandate of the people. An election supervisory agency said there was a lack of evidence to support claims of systematic cheating, and independent observers have said the poll was free and fair. The result released by the General Election Commission gave Widodo more than 55% of the votes. Some schools and offices in the capital have been closed down this week. The government also says dozens of militant Islamists have been detained, suspected of planning attacks in the turmoil. In a bid to quell the unrest, Indonesia introduced curbs on social media on Wednesday. They say it's designed to prevent the spread of hoaxes and fake news, some calling for violent post-election attacks. The move imposes limits on the ability to upload videos or photos on social media platforms.
That was Reuters reporter Francesca Linaw, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is Voice of America's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. North Korean state media has ventured into commentary on the upcoming 2020 U.S. presidential elections. Pyongyang's official Korean Central News Agency called former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden and 2020 hopeful bereft of elementary quality as a human being. Now, for more on North Korea's commentary on U.S. leaders, I spoke earlier with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo. Bill, what did the KCNA state in terms of its online commentary that made it single out former Vice President Joe Biden, who's in the 2020 election hunt for the Democrat nomination?
Well, KCNA released a commentary yesterday calling Joe Biden an imbecile, a fool of low IQ. There were all these kind of typical insults that you find in the English language version of KCNA and other North Korean state media. It specifically was taking aim at recent comments that Joe Biden had made regarding North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump's outreach to him. Biden has been very critical of that outreach, saying that Donald Trump should not sort of cozy up to dictators and tyrants. And that is the language that North Korea was objecting to here.
Now, you bring up President Donald Trump, who, as you said, is engaged in a line of dialogue with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. However, the KCNA and North Korea has taken aim at President Trump previously before all this diplomacy started, correct?
Right. In the past, they have, of course, called Donald Trump a dotard, most famously, I think, in 2017. 2017 actually saw a very steady stream of insults coming from North Korea at Donald Trump. However, since this diplomacy between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. North Korean state media and officials have really backed off the criticism of Donald Trump. In fact, it has been a long time since we've seen any direct criticism of Donald Trump in North Korean state media. Instead, what they will do is they will hit out at U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo or National Security Advisor John Bolton, and at quite firmly, in fact. But I think they realize there's a line that can't be crossed right now in order to preserve the idea or the possibility of these negotiations in the future. And that line is criticizing Donald Trump. However, I think that KCNA is, and other North Korean officials are a bit hesitant, typically anyway, to formally endorse or be seen as formally endorsing U.S. presidential candidates. In fact, until 2016, you really didn't see North Korea weigh in on U.S. elections as far as supporting one candidate over the other. In 2016, there was a China-based North Korean propaganda outlet that referred to Donald Trump as wise and far-sighted, while referring to his opponent Hillary Clinton as being dull and bad for North Korea. So for whatever reason, possibly it's because Donald Trump is just unlike any other U.S. president, they have felt more comfortable in North Korea attacking his opponents or even at times saying nice things about him.
And that was VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo speaking to me from South Korea. Microbrewing is not a modern invention. Monks at the Grimbergen Abbey in Belgium are preparing to open a brewery using recipes and brewing instructions last used more than 200 years ago. And meanwhile, Israeli scientists brewed beer and mead using yeast extracted from ancient clay vessels, some over 5,000 years old. For that story, we turn to Zlatica Hoek.
Beer connoisseurs' perpetual quest for new and interesting brews has sparked a global trend of microbreweries offering their own specialty beers. Monks at Grimbergen Abbey in Belgium have looked into their own beer-making past and decided to revive the order's brewing heritage.
Brewing and religion life, it was always come together. And when we have now the opportunity to also give, and with the support of Alkemaas and the support of Carlsberg, you don't must wait from that. And so that was the start of a dream to bring back the Grimbergen in a little part here in the microbrewery.
The monks are combining old recipes detailed in books, some dating back to the 12th century, with modern techniques to craft limited edition batches.
So what will be special about the beer? We will keep our Grimbergen DNA, which is a yeast, and we will also use some local ingredients. For example, we are start to grow hops in the garden of the abbey. So we are thinking about limited batch that will bring some hops from the garden, and also working with local farmers and local actors here in Grimbergen.
The Grimbergen microbrewery will open to the public in late 2020 and is projected to produce about 10,000 hectoliters of beer at the abbey. Larger quantities will be produced in other countries. The interest in ancient brewing methods doesn't stop there. Israeli researchers say they have extracted yeast from the remains of jars found at archaeological sites and have used them to concoct a brew similar to the kind imbibed by pharaohs thousands of years ago.
We know that they used wheat, they used yeast, they used water, and they didn't have any preservators like today for the beer. Now what they added, there were some flavoring material like date concentration and things like this, maybe honey.
On Wednesday, researchers from Jerusalem's Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University presented a beer brewed with yeast descended from a 3,000-year-old jar. They plan to combine ancient recipes with modern methods to brew beer that could one day be produced commercially. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
And finally, Asian markets were broadly lower on Thursday as traders focused on tensions between the United States and China and braced for their impact on tariff hikes. Also on Wall Street, trade worries also mixed corporate earnings pulled stocks lower. And that is going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Gary Burns, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow Voice of America on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a tremendous Thursday.